Welcome to episode 271 of the Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, April 28th, 2013. I am the Solomonster. Tomorrow, April 29th, will mark the 50th anniversary of the WWE Championship. That was the day that Buddy Rogers was declared the very first Worldwide Wrestling Federation champion. We're going to talk about the 50th anniversary of the title a little bit later on the Sound Off this week, and I will give my personal top 10 list of the greatest WWE Championship matches of all time, which is bound to piss some people off. It is my personal list of favorite title matches from over the years, so we're going to get to that a little bit later on. But first, I want to mention for those who may have missed it that the Sound Off is now an app for your Android device. For those of you who actually use Android devices, you can get the Solomonster Sounds Off as an official app in the Google Play Store. It is free. You can log on, type in Solomonster. It should be the only thing that comes up. And you can download the official app, stream the most recent shows. Shows going all the way back, in fact, to episode 85 in the archives. Apparently work for most people. So you can download the app. And if you would be so kind as to rate the app, leave a review, that would be awesome. But for those of you that use Android, just wanted to make mention of that up front here. We have some breaking news this morning regarding the WWE champion, John Cena. WWE.com posted an article a little bit earlier before I began recording here that John Cena sustained an injury during the WWE European tour that just concluded. Apparently it was a right Achilles tendon injury while battling Ryback. And the item on WWE's website says that the injury raises questions about the scheduled match between Cena and Ryback at Extreme Rules on May 19th. What lies ahead for the C-Nation leader, says the story. Does this put Ryback one step closer to capturing the WWE title? So, basically, they're very short on details as far as what happened and whether or not Cena will be out for any extended length of time. An Achilles tendon injury is a very serious injury. A lot of athletes suffer that, and you can be out of action for many months. Edge suffered a very serious Achilles tendon injury. I don't know if it was a full tear. He was gone for quite a long time. If I remember correctly, he suffered that injury Edge did in a match at a house show against Jeff Hardy, and I think all he did was jump up, I think, did a leapfrog, landed wrong on his foot, and suffered an Achilles injury. So they're very short on details here. They don't tell you much. And the way this item is phrased, it almost screams angle to me. Like they're just doing something to further the storyline between these two guys heading into the pay-per-view. Maybe give Cena a storyline injury that gives Ryback an advantage. So if Ryback by chance happens to beat John Cena at the pay-per-view, they have this built-in excuse now with this fake injury. I don't know if it's real or if it's not. This is all just breaking this morning. The Raw tour ended on Saturday night. They had a show over in Poland. Apparently, the main event of that show was John Cena, Kane, and Daniel Bryan against Ryback, Dolph Ziggler, and Big E Langston. So I assume that must be where this supposed injury took place when Cena and Ryback maybe were in the ring together at one point. There were no reports that I saw of Cena showing any sign of injury during the match or after the match. And in fact, John Cena pinned Dolph Ziggler in the end with an attitude adjustment and seemed to look just fine. So I don't know what's going on here exactly. This is all coming from WWE.com. If it's legit, it's obviously poor timing. Cena just came off a big championship win at WrestleMania over The Rock. Hasn't even had one title defense yet, I don't think, unless he had one on Raw that I'm forgetting. But this could work to their advantage for a number of reasons. Obviously, anytime there's an injury report, fake or real, that John Cena is hurt and may be out for an extended period of time, you have the bottom dwellers who come out and they post stuff like, oh, you know, this is great. This is great news. I already saw people on the SE Scoops thread on Facebook saying, a million likes! And I get what they're saying. They're obviously very sick of John Cena, and anytime John Cena goes away and somebody else steps up in his place is a positive thing in these people's eyes. I don't think most of these people mean ill will towards John Cena. Some do. Those are the bottom dwellers that I'm referring to. But the fact is, what do you do? If John Cena's hurt and can't go at the pay-per-view, does it put WWE in a bind? Not really. It doesn't have to. And in fact, I was just thinking about this before I started recording here. If John Cena is legitimately hurt and he cannot wrestle at the pay-per-view, and the pay-per-view is still many weeks away, so if it's not a full tear or a major injury, I could see him saying, listen, I'm going to be at the pay-per-view. Hold me out until then. I can wrestle. I'll be okay. It harkens back to the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view last year. If you remember, John Cena had an elbow injury, and there was talk that maybe he would wrestle. Either the company would try to, you know, force him to wrestle or he would want to, but he had surgery. They cut it too close. He couldn't wrestle. They did the whole replacement deal, and instead it was CM Punk and Ryback. Could we have a repeat of that here, where the company rushes CM Punk back early to wrestle Ryback yet again for the championship in a pay-per-view main event because John Cena is hurt? I don't think so, nor do I like that idea, because I like the idea of keeping CM Punk off television, or at the very least out of the ring as long as possible, even off TV completely, because I feel like it'll mean more when he comes back. You know, the dude obviously is, he's been on the road, balls to the wall, 434 days as champion. Sounds like he's pretty banged up and hurt right now. I say let him have time off to heal up, have fun, do whatever he wants. And if he comes back in July, if he comes back in August, it'll mean more once he's back. Plus, I think CM Punk is great as a heel. Way too early to turn him back into a babyface. I would not do that. So take CM Punk off the table. If John Cena is hurt and he can't wrestle, what do you do? Well, tomorrow, as I mentioned earlier, is the 50th anniversary of the WWE Championship, which happens to be a Monday night. I know WWE in the past has been averse to doing tournaments before. They do them here and there, but I get the impression they don't like doing tournaments very often. Maybe it's a Vince McMahon thing. I don't know. Why not have a tournament, a one-night tournament on Raw, to crown another number one contender, because Ryback is the number one contender, but crown another number one contender for the WWE Championship. The winner meeting Ryback for the vacant championship at Extreme Rules. So yes, take the title off John Cena. He can't wrestle. Let's say he can't wrestle. It's a legitimate injury. He's going to need quite a bit of time off. You vacate the championship. You have the winner of this tournament tomorrow night meet Ryback in the main event of the pay-per-view. Now, who do you put against Ryback? Who wins this tournament? The first name that popped into my head was Chris Jericho. And if you remember, Chris Jericho and Ryback was the rumored match for WrestleMania. In fact, Chris Jericho did an interview on the Observer website before WrestleMania, and he outright admitted that the plan was Chris Jericho against Ryback at WrestleMania, straight from the horse's mouth. That was going to be the match, and then plans changed, and Fandango became Vince McMahon's pet project, and he wanted Jericho in there with him, and they went with Henry and Ryback. So here's an opportunity to do the WrestleMania match that never was. Chris Jericho, certainly, I mean, look, Ryback is not awful or anything like that, but I think Ryback could go in there and probably have a pretty kick-ass match if he's in the ring with Chris Jericho, and Jericho doesn't have to win. In fact, Ryback wins, and finally, after all this time, Ryback gets his big win on pay-per-view, which has eluded him now for many months, and he gets to win the championship and carry the title for a little bit. Because if anybody has had a pretty far from sterling pay-per-view record over the last several months, and has been just beaten down and beaten down and beaten down. Even Mark Henry fell on his head. He got pinned at WrestleMania. It's Ryback. Now they turned him heel. Now they want to turn him into an even bigger monster. You know, in that respect, he really shouldn't lose at Extreme Rules. And he could easily beat Jericho. Jericho doesn't lose anything for it. And when Cena comes back, now Cena is in the position of chasing for the championship, which I know he was doing that before WrestleMania, but let's be honest. It does kind of make more sense to have the babyface chasing the heel champion. Traditionally. That's typically how this works. If you have John Cena as the champion and he's facing this guy, he beats him. He faces this guy, he beats him. It's lacking that drama. In a way, it almost writes itself. So I don't think this is an awful situation for them to be in. If Cena goes away for a few weeks, not the worst thing in the world. They do a tournament, they have Jericho Ryback to promote as a suitable replacement main event for the pay-per-view. If you don't want Jericho in there, fine, put Randy Orton in there. Randy Orton hasn't exactly been booked as a main event level guy over the last few months, but I don't recall there being a Ryback-Randy Orton match. Could be a good match, and again, Orton wouldn't win, so you can go with either one of those guys. But again, color me skeptical about this whole, just the way the whole story on the website is phrased. I don't know how legit this really is, and maybe he is hurt, but it's really not all that bad. So they decided, okay, let's turn this into a storyline. I don't know. But that's just one idea that I if I were in the position of having to come up with a replacement idea and John Cena was out, that's the idea that I would go with. And I would give Ryback a shot, and when Cena comes back, he chases him for the title and he can win the championship back again for his 11th reign or 12th, or I've lost track already. However many reigns he's had as champion. It doesn't even matter at this point. Speaking of big names that may not be around anymore, that brings us to The Rock. The Rock has been in the news quite a bit of late. Rock did an interview with Peter Rosenberg of Hot 97 just to clear up some rumors about what happened the night after WrestleMania. and talk about his future, or lack thereof, inside the ring, and Rock outright said that might have been my last match. You know, the plan was for me to come back and do the honors with John Cena, and there really was no plan after that, and now that he got hurt, it obviously is a situation where he realizes, you know, do I have to come back? Do I want to come back and do this? And then he tweeted about it later on, and he answered a question from a fan, and he said, again, Mania may have been my last match. 3-year goal was to come in, elevate WWE, and then proudly do the honors. Now, do I think that Rock has wrestled his last match? No. Absolutely not. I don't believe that for a second. But if the off chance is that he did in fact wrestle his last match, I'm happy for him. He had a plan. He came back. He was around for 3 years, right? Remember WrestleMania 27, he was the host. That was the first leg of the plan. And I don't want to lay it all at the feet of The Rock because he's an entertaining guy and it was obviously part of a bigger plan that, I mean, the next 2 years after WrestleMania 27, the company did bigger business for WrestleMania than they've ever done before. You know, the preliminary numbers just came out for this year's Mania show. $72 million made overall on this event. Well over a million buys on pay-per-view. It's hard to argue that it was a bad plan. But WrestleMania 27 was probably among the worst overall of the WrestleMania show. Certainly, in terms of WrestleMania main events, it was the worst, in my opinion. But you had Rock on that show, you know, rock-bottoming John Cena at the end, costing him the championship. Then came the first match, then came the second match. And there's no doubt, whatever you think about The Rock, and, you know, he went on some of those television shows and didn't mention WWE or have the belt with him, and then others he did. He brought a lot of attention and eyeballs, even if only temporarily, on the product. So yeah, maybe not all those people are going to continue to watch WWE now that he's gone. But you know what? They watched him for a time, and the numbers were huge. They sold out a ton of shows. I mean, there was a period of time for many years, up until recently, where WWE, they wouldn't sell out arenas anymore like they used to. And once WrestleMania season rolls around, generally speaking, people are more interested. But, I mean, there's no doubt The Rock helped out a lot in terms of sellouts, in terms of tickets sold, in terms of pay-per-view buys. That's why you bring the guy in. He's a different kind of star. And if he wants to wrestle and he still loves this, what are you going to say, no? You're an idiot if you do that. So, it was fun having Rock back, and I enjoyed, for the most part, I enjoyed his stuff, and if it is his last match, then he's got nothing to be ashamed of. You know, he came in, he did what he was going to do. Won the championship, and he put over the top star. Now, you know, could he have put somebody else over? Like he said in his interview, because Rosenberg asked him that question. He was kind of evasive on that in a way. It's not like he came to John Cena's defense. He basically said, look, he was the guy that the company wanted, so I did it. So the plan was to elevate Cena. Could it have been somebody else? Yeah, maybe it could have been. I don't know who that person would have been. Maybe CM Punk before he went heel? I don't know. But do I think Rock wrestled his last match? No. And Rock admitted in the interview the plan was for him to be on Raw that night at the Izod Center and do an angle where Brock Lesnar would lay him out. And that would set up either the main event or the co-main event, certainly, of WrestleMania 30 in New Orleans next year. Now that match is up in the air because Rock, I do believe Rock is just really not sure what he wants to do. And he's hurt right now. Who knows, you know, how long it'll take for him to fully heal. His mother was at the Cauliflower Alley Club ceremony a few weeks ago in Vegas and gave an interview to Arta Ocal and basically said that she hopes he does come back. Rock is still very close to his mother. I'm sure they talk quite a bit. I don't know if she said that she thinks he will, but she says, I hope he does. There's a lot of people that hope he comes back. And I hope he does too, because other than Brock Lesnar, let's say for some reason the match with Lesnar doesn't happen, or it does, and he wants to keep wrestling. There's three other really good opponents for him that I would love to see him in the ring with. One of which is Randy Orton, which, by the way, if they were to do a Rock-Randy Orton feud in the near future, obviously they're not. But if they did, that'd be a nice way to turn Randy Orton in the course of that feud. Chris Jericho is another name. That's a selfish name, I admit. Jericho is, you know, 40-something years old, and we've already seen Rock vs. Jericho before. But it's been over a decade since we've seen Rock vs. Jericho, and Jericho seems to have only gotten better with age. I wouldn't necessarily say the same thing about The Rock. He's just so much bigger and ripped than he used to be. He's not as quick. He may not be quite as good. But selfishly, I'd love to see a Rock-Jericho match. I just think it would be a lot of fun. And Dolph Ziggler. You know, and I give Dolph Ziggler a lot of praise. I'm not saying he's the end-all, be-all, but he's very good. And I think him working with a guy like The Rock could probably give Rock the best match he's had since he come back. I'm sure that a Rock-Ziggler match, in terms of an actual wrestling match, would be a hell of a lot better than Rock versus Cena. But they'd all be really good matches I'd like to see. You know, but he already wrestled the biggest name on the WWE roster. It really was the biggest match they could have done. I don't care if you like John Cena or not. There's no bigger star in WWE full-time right now than John Cena. So they did the biggest match they could do. The first one, not the rematch. I wasn't really much of a fan of the rematch. But we'll see what happens. You know, Rock is going to be gone for a while. He'll think about it, and I'm sure when he's good and ready to make up his mind, he'll let Vince McMahon know, and that way the company will know whether or not we're going to be forging ahead with Rock and Brock next year, or if they have to find a different opponent for Brock Lesnar. Because that's another big question that is going to have to be answered very soon. Another announcement from WWE this week. Apparently there is a new Divas reality show. I think the name of it is Total Diva. I think that might be the name of it, but anyway, it's going to be airing on the E! Network coming up this summer, I believe. Debuts this July on the E! Network, in fact. And I guess the concept is they're following two new divas that are coming to WWE television soon, one of whom, her name is Natalia Eva Marie. I guess her ring name will be Eva Marie, a former fashion model. The other one is Josanne Alexi Offerman, who is Dominican and has singing and dancing experience. She will be known as JoJo Offerman. That will be her name on television. And basically, the concept of the show, if this press release is accurate, is following the two of them as they try to navigate their way through the WWE locker room and they get their career started. And there'll be cameos on the show and appearances by other divas like the Bella Twins and the Funkadactyls and Natalya and maybe Caitlyn and people like that. So my impression is it's not really a diva show following the current crop of divas, but it's more focused on these two new divas that I guess will be popping up on television soon. And we'll see how it is. I mean, I thought Tough Enough was actually a really good show. This, I don't know, production-wise, who is in charge of this show. For example, there was a company named Shed Media. They were really the ones responsible for what you saw on television with Tough Enough. It wasn't like Kevin Dunn and WWE produced the whole show. I mean, they had their input. So I don't know if it's a similar situation here where E! Or some other company is working on the show, or if this is going to be all WWE. That I don't know. I would certainly check out the first episode. I can't say beyond that if it's the type of thing I'd be interested in. But at least they're giving some attention to the divas. I guess that's a plus. Remember when they did that online survey a few months ago, asking fans what roles they wanted to see the divas in most? Noah Mark, actually, I think, was the one who alerted me of this. He told me that he had heard through the grapevine that somebody he knew had taken this survey. And apparently they gave you a whole list of items where you can mark off what role do you want to see the divas in most? As wrestlers? Or do you want to see them in, for example, a television sitcom? Or maybe a reality show? So I take it that the fans voted for reality show. Either that or they're just ignoring the fans and doing whatever they want. So that debuts in July on E!, interestingly enough. Not on USA. And not on the new network either, which is also, I think, very telling, because one of the ideas for the new network was to have original programming just like this. There was talk of a Divas show, there was talk of a cruiserweight-style show, which they still may or may not do if this network ever actually happens. And then they have that Legends House reality show, which I actually am dying to watch. I am way more interested in watching Legends House than I am Total Diva. And Legends House is in the can, and I guess they're not going to air it until the network is up and running, so I wish they'd get their act together and figure out what the hell they're doing with this network. My big fear was you have so many older guys that were part of that cast on Legends House, and that show wrapped up filming months ago. The longer you sit on this footage and wait, my fear is that, God forbid, something happens to one of these guys that's on the show, and then that just makes it weird if the show airs, you know, 2 years later with somebody who's no longer with us on there. So hopefully they find a place for that show, because I'd much rather watch that. Let's move on to Raw from Monday night, emanating from London, England at the O2 Arena. Much better show than last week. Fun London crowd, which started their own wave. So apparently Noah Mark has started a worldwide phenomenon. You can credit him or blame him for that. Triple H made an appearance on this show. He accepted Brock Lesnar's challenge to a steel cage match at Extreme Rules, so that match is now official. He left Paul Heyman laying with a pedigree. R-Truth pinned Antonio Cesaro in a very short match. apparently they're now doing the losing streak angle with Cesaro, because that always works so well. Actually, that and 5 months off television got Jack Swagger a world title match at WrestleMania, so maybe this will lead somewhere for Antonio Cesaro. I hope it does. If he drops the yodeling and he ends up, you know, getting something out of this, then I'm totally okay with this. But as of right now, it's not a good time to be a fan of Antonio Cesaro. They showed The Shield making a really cool helicopter entrance before getting in there. I don't know if it was a limo or what the hell it was, but very horseman-esque entrance here. And apparently the chopper ride was legit. They even had Fandango in there with them. Apparently they all wrestled earlier that night at the SmackDown House Show in Cardiff, Wales. And The Shield opened that show against Sheamus and the New Age Outlaws, and Fandango wrestled Ted DiBiase, who is in fact still employed in WWE. And they basically opened the show with those guys so they could just rush them over to Raw. So, all legit, all really cool stuff here. Later on, they had a Shield backstage promo trashing The Undertaker, with Dean Ambrose doing the lion's share of the talking. And I'll tell you what, you know, what a week for Dean Ambrose. You know, landing in London by helicopter, where he earns the winning pinfall in the six-man tag over The Undertaker and Team Hell No, and then he gets to wrestle The Undertaker the very next night at the SmackDown tapings in a rare singles match on TV for the Dead Man. So if there's any question about who WWE sees as having the most potential in that group right now, then there should be no debate. It is Dean Ambrose. And I saw that match on SmackDown, by the way. It's the only thing I had time to watch. I went back and watched that match. Good match. I wish it were longer. But anybody expecting a 20-minute Undertaker match on free TV is fooling themselves. You know, you get 20-minute Undertaker matches or 30-minute Undertaker matches at WrestleMania. But if this match would have been like another 5 minutes, it would have been awesome. But as it was still very cool to see Ambrose in there with Undertaker. Undertaker beat him with the Hell's Gate. So technically speaking, The Shield suffered their first loss at the hands of The Undertaker on SmackDown. But it was a singles match. It was not a six-man tag team match. Dolph Ziggler beat Chris Jericho after nearly 20 minutes of maybe the weakest match I've seen the two of them have together, and this was still a really good match. So that speaks volumes about how good these two guys are. The fact that I've seen them in a bunch of other matches, all of which were better than this one, and this match was still really good. Jericho had the match won. Fandango's music started playing, so I guess he must have held up the production guy or something, because I don't know why Fandango's music would suddenly play out of nowhere, and Fandango didn't even come out. But this was enough to distract Jericho. Dolph nailed him with a zigzag, got the pin. Backstage, Josh Matthews interviewed Mick Foley, who happened to be in town for his own comedy tour, and he's the general manager for Saturday Morning Slam as well, so he was at the SmackDown tapings. And Josh asked Mick Foley how the Attitude Era compares to today's WWE, which was perhaps the most bizarre question I've ever heard Josh Matthews ask during one of these segments. You know, if they were promoting the WWE 13 video game, which has an Attitude Era mode, I guess that would have made sense, but this just seemed like a random, pointless question for him to ask, and even worse, Mick Foley completely evaded the question, never even gave a straight answer, because let's be honest here, it's not an answer I think WWE would probably want to really hear on TV if you ask somebody, hey, how does the Attitude Era compare to today's WWE? 9 out of 10 people probably wouldn't give you the answer that you would want to broadcast. Later on, Ryback called out Mick Foley after, I guess Foley talked about Ryback not taking responsibility for his own actions or something like that. I wasn't a fan of the story they were telling on this show with Foley and Ryback. It just felt forced to me. Big E Langston has his own entrance music now, which I quite like. He beat Zack Ryder in a squash. Then we had the six-man tag. This was the match I was most looking forward to. The Undertaker, his first Raw match in nearly 3 years, I believe, teaming up with Kane and Daniel Bryan to take on The Shield. The Shield has yet to have a six-man tag match that I would call bad. All of them are good to great. You know, going back to that TLC match in December. I love The Undertaker in there doing his thing. He looked great in this match, all things considered. You know, he was moving around, he was working hard, you know. They could have easily hid The Undertaker in this match, let's say if he, you know, wasn't feeling well, or if they didn't want to put him in there for too long. They, you know, it's a tag match, so he could have jumped in the ring, done a few moves, tagged out, and had Daniel Bryan do the lion's share of the work. And there was a stretch during this match where Bryan was in the driver's seat. He got cut off. They beat him down for a long time. before Undertaker got the tag back in. But Undertaker did more than I thought he would in this match, and he wrestled again the next night. So I think that's awesome. And if he's feeling great, I think that's fantastic. I think it bodes well for another Undertaker match next year at WrestleMania, which, not that I thought it wouldn't happen, but every year we seem to go through this cycle. Will the Undertaker wrestle? I don't think there's any doubt that he'll wrestle next year unless he gets hurt somehow. But he looked real good here. I did want to comment on one thing. One of our listeners pointed this out, a link to an article. I saw where a writer over at The Torch got all uppity over the fact that the fans in London during this match were chanting, "You still got it," at The Undertaker. That the fans were somehow disrespecting him by doing that. And I hope this guy used soap and water to wash his hands after pulling that out of his ass, because how he could see that as a sign of disrespect is beyond me. I mean, I guess his idea was, well, The Undertaker always had it, so how could he lose it in the first place? The problem is, when did the fans ever say The Undertaker didn't have it? You know, we know he goes in there, he busts his ass, he still has great matches. We also know, dude's almost 50 years old, has bad hips, bad knees, only wrestles once or twice a year. The fans want to let him know that he's still got it. I take that as a sign of respect. I think the guy was reaching on that point there. Undertaker at one point during this match got pissed. Boy, did he get pissed off at Seth Rollins. Not because Rollins did anything wrong. Rollins did everything right. Rollins was great here, bumping around, and there was one point he was taunting The Undertaker, and they had a shot of Taker standing on the apron just flipping out. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen Undertaker get that angry and animated before. Maybe when he was the American Badass or Big Evil, but certainly not as the Dead Man. So, in the end, Dean Ambrose got the pin on Daniel Bryan, who missed his top rope headbutt. Shield escapes with another win. This was a great match. I loved it. This was the highlight of Raw to me. Fandango beat William Regal in a way too short match. Fans were into the Fandangoing here, as we all suspected they would be, but they were actually more into William Regal when he came out, as well they should be. And if you blinked, you missed this match. Why they can't give Fandango 10 or 12 minutes to work with a guy like William Regal on a three-hour show, your guess is as good as mine, but I mean, maybe it was a wise decision on WWE's part, because this match lost nearly a million viewers on Monday night. I'm still a numbers mark. You know, I look around for the ratings and the quarter hours and all that stuff just because I'm curious, even though the show has no direct competition anymore on Monday nights. And that was something that jumped out at me, because you normally don't see one segment in the middle of the show lose that many people at once. I seem to recall there being a match that Sheamus was involved in last year at some point. I can't remember. It might have been Sheamus and David Otunga also lost some ridiculous number like that. But that, I mean, almost a million people tuned out during this match. Now, it did come right after the Undertaker match, so you would expect that some people who tuned in were going to tune out as soon as that match was over. The Undertaker match picked up about 580,000 people, and then Fandango's segment shed 950,000 people. And of all things, if you can believe it, the Divas Battle Royal later on gained back about 300,000 of those viewers. So for the people saying, well, it was all because the Undertaker's match, and of course those people were going to tune out, that doesn't account for a bunch of those people coming back for the women's match later on. So, again, his theme music is over, people. He's not. You know, maybe he will be at some point, but don't get too wrapped up in this whole Fandango craze. Jericho attacked him on stage after the match. He danced with his woman, who was actually NXT diva Summer Rae, who I believe might be the permanent woman going forward. She's a pretty girl. I'm kind of sad, though. I do miss the original dancer. She was a beautiful lady. AJ Lee won a Divas Battle Royal by playing dead after Tamina super kicked her into oblivion. And instead of doing the obvious thing, which is pick up the carcass and dump her out, she just left her and turned her attention elsewhere. So Layla tried to dump out AJ later on. She was dead weight. AJ suddenly came back to life and knocked Layla out of the ring. She was playing possum. Smart girl. Looks like she may be taking the title from Caitlyn soon. That's certainly the next championship match coming up for the Divas title. And you know, you got Dolph Ziggler already holding the World Heavyweight title. Would not surprise me to see them have Langston take the United States Championship from Kofi Kingston. Because if you have AJ beat Caitlyn, Dolph already has the world title. You've got that trio. They're obviously putting over Langston now as a single star. Kofi Kingston just beat Antonio Cesaro for the belt for reasons that I still don't understand. But perhaps the idea was to use Kofi as a transitional champion, and who knows, maybe Big E will have some gold soon, and then all three of them will have belts. Foley and Ryback had their in-ring confrontation at the end of the show. Not one of Mick Foley's more memorable promos, and I'm not saying that because he did a bad job, but just because I thought the source material was lacking. You know, it just felt like, oh, Mick Foley is overseas, and, you know, he's here, we may as well get him involved in this storyline. I guess to help get Ryback more over as a heel, which is not a bad reason. You know, it's not a bad way to use the legends, but I don't know. The whole thing just rang hollow to me. We also had fans chanting "What" at Mick Foley during his promo, which is just, you know, even if it was a bit dull, and I do think his promo compared to some other ones he's done was a bit dull. As I said, when the fans once gave Undertaker the "What" treatment on Raw a few years ago, there's certain guys you just don't do that to. You know, Mick Foley, to me, is one of those guys. So I thought that was a tad bit disrespectful. For his part, I thought Ryback did a pretty good job here. He showed some real good intensity and emotion, kept telling Mick Foley to shut up a whole bunch of times. John Cena eventually ran out to get between Ryback and Foley. Foley bailed because he just really can't take bumps anymore. Shield's music hit. They came down to the ring, only this time it was John Cena who bailed and left Ryback to fend for himself. And Cena did end up running in with a steel chair to beat down the Shield, and he gave Ryback an AA, left him laying at the end of the show. And the main event for Raw this Monday was announced to be John Cena and Ryback as partners against the Shield when they returned to U.S. soil on Monday in Columbus, Ohio. It's the old adversaries as partners gimmick. We've seen it a million times, and now with this John Cena injury that WWE just announced, I would tend to think this match is not going to happen on Monday, but that was the main event they had promoted last week, so we'll see, I guess, if they do it, or if they come up with a replacement bout, maybe a handicap match, Ryback in the Shield. I don't know. I would expect Cena on Raw, even if he is hurt, so this match is up in the air right now. I mentioned earlier that this Monday, April 29th, marks the 50th anniversary of the WWE Championship, and in fact, that was the subject I covered on my latest Layfield Report.com column this week, celebrating 50 years of the WWE Championship, which should be up right now by the time you listen to this, up on LayfieldReport.com. Basically, it talks about some brief history of the title, not a terribly long column, just touching on who I feel are the most prominent names to hold the championship in the past, some people that really only had a cup of coffee with the belt, which means they just didn't hold it for very long. Even talking about the physical transformation that the championship has undergone over the years, going from, you remember those belts back in the day, they were very small and almost flimsy looking in some cases compared to these monstrosities that they have on TV now. I mean, anybody who has seen some of these titles up close when you've met a superstar, or even if you WrestleMania weekend, if you popped your head in the WrestleMania store over at the Izod Center, they had full-scale replicas of these championship belts. And they're huge, you know, and they weigh more than some midget wrestlers probably do. So even the physical title, and back in the day you had the Winged Eagle and you had the international flags and the globes and all that stuff. And now you've got the Brahma Bull side plates or the You Can't See Me side plates. So the championship belt itself has undergone quite the transformation. In fact, I know one member of the SE Scoops family here, Steve Perry, on his breakdown podcast at the end of the week, did a whole show devoted to the physical title belts. And I myself fancy myself a fan of the physical title belts. Classic Winged Eagle look from 88 to 98 being my favorite, the Intercontinental title and all that stuff. But you dig a little bit deeper when it comes to the WWE Championship. And really, again, you talk about the men who have held the championship over the years. And actually, you really need to go back to the origins of the title in that Buddy Rogers essentially was awarded the championship in 1963, April 29th, 1963. They claim that he beat Antonino Rocca in the finals of a tournament that was held in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Which, if that sounds familiar to you, you might recall that WWE also claims that Pat Patterson became the first Intercontinental Champion by defeating Ted DiBiase, I think it was, in the finals of a tournament in, where else? Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I don't know what it is about Brazil, but apparently that's where championships are born. Only not really, because both tournaments are phantom tournaments. There's no record of them having ever taken place, so it's all bullshit. So Buddy Rogers is the first champion. Bruno Sammartino beat him for the title. And even that, there's a whole history as far as how that whole thing went down. And Buddy Rogers supposedly suffered a heart attack and really was in no physical condition to be champion any longer. Lost the title to Bruno in like under a minute. Bruno has claimed that he never had a heart attack. He just didn't want to do the job. So even back then, wrestling politics alive and well, even in the 1960s. Bruno Sammartino, though, really is the first person, the first prominent person to hold the championship, and that he held the championship for so long. You know, he really made that championship as valuable as it became by holding on to it as long as he did. He was a big star. He went around to different places and different territories and wrestled a whole bunch of different people, and Bruno was the first really prolific name to hold the WWE Championship. And after Bruno, the other name you think of is Hulk Hogan. A lot of people are fans of Hogan. A lot of people are not fans of Hulk Hogan. Doesn't matter what camp you fall into, and I say this to people all the time about John Cena, like him or not, Hogan will go down as certainly one of, if not perhaps, the biggest name in the history of modern day United States professional wrestling. Hogan was the man. He was the man on top for many years. Bruno held the championship for something like 8 years. Hogan's first title reign went over 4. And obviously, subsequent to that, he held the championship many more times. He had that match with Andre the Giant on NBC back in 1988, the disputed finish with the evil Hebner twins. And to this day, that match is still the most watched professional wrestling match in U.S. history. And I say U.S. history again because I can't vouch for Japan. I know there have been some pretty big matches over the years in Japan, but certainly in this country, something like 33 million people at one point or another, maybe not for the entire length of the match, but at one point or another, 33 million people tuned in to see Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, which is a shame in a way because even though it was a meeting between two of the biggest names in the business at the time, the match itself was just complete shit. You almost hope that a match like that gets that many eyeballs. You can put on like 15 minutes of really exciting wrestling and that match was, in terms of the match itself, was pretty far from exciting, but the finish certainly was memorable. One of the more memorable finishes in a championship match of all time, and there's been a lot of great moments over the years when it comes to the WWE title. Mick Foley winning his first championship in 99, you know, and the whole thing with Tony Schiavone on Nitro saying, yeah, that'll put butts in seats, and we all know that story, and that was a great moment. You had Edge being the first person to cash in Money in the Bank, win his first championship from John Cena at the New Year's Revolution pay-per-view. Hogan slamming Andre at the Pontiac Silverdome, another memorable moment. Hogan missing the leg drop at WrestleMania 6 and Warrior becoming the man, which didn't last very long. It was less than a year before Hogan got the belt back. There's been a whole bunch of people probably who held the championship who probably had no business being champion. And no offense, but Sergeant Slaughter as WWE champion, really? I don't know about that one. Iron Sheik, too, you can make the argument. Although we know why. In both cases, they were made champion as a transition to get the belt on Hulk Hogan. Diesel. We tried to create a new Hulk Hogan in Diesel. They tried it with Lex Luger. Didn't work. Although Luger never held the belt. But the idea with Diesel was, let's create a new star. And you know what? They did create a new star. But as champion, Diesel didn't exactly light the box office on fire. As opposed to, say, somebody like a Stone Cold Steve Austin. Or The Rock. And John Cena has been the man for what? 7 years now? 7 or 8 years? So when I think of the top 5 most prolific, impactful champions in WWE history, I think of these names in no particular order. I think of Bruno Sammartino. I think of Hulk Hogan. I think of Stone Cold Steve Austin. I think of The Rock. And I think of John Cena. Those are your 5. And there have been a lot of great champions. Superstar Billy Graham had a memorable title reign, although it wasn't that long. Randy Macho Man Savage, Bret the Hitman Hart, Shawn Michaels, The Undertaker. You know, some of the biggest names in WWE history. I would not rank them in the top 5 of world champions all time in WWE, specifically WWE champions. Bruno, Hogan, Austin, Rock, and Cena, I would rank ahead of them. And yes, Bret and Shawn had much better matches than Rock probably did. Rock became a much bigger star after he was already out of the company, after he had already won the championship a whole bunch of times. Maybe he just came along at the right time. But to me, when I think of that of that championship and then the names and the impact they had, the staying power, their drawing ability, the money that they made, all of those things in totality, not just, you know, did they have a great match? In this case, it doesn't really matter. Rock would be on that list. Although, again, he probably would be lower on the list, but he would be on the list. So those are the five names I think of. You also think of the names of men who never were WWE champion, but perhaps should have been champion. They were, in some cases, almost were. You know, the story of Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man, supposed to be winning the championship at WrestleMania 4. And obviously that did not happen. Honky Tonk Man didn't want to drop the Intercontinental title to Randy Savage on that same main event show I just mentioned a few minutes ago that had the Hogan-Andre match. I guess the original idea had been for Savage to win the Intercontinental title back from Honky Tonk Man on that show, who had since beaten Steamboat, who was the person who beat Savage at WrestleMania 3. So just so you understand the whole chain of events here. And in the end, it was Randy Savage who ended up becoming the WWE champion instead, and that worked out tremendously well. Probably worked out a lot better than it would have even with DiBiase as champion. DiBiase was just a victim of either politics or timing or circumstances or whatever, but DiBiase could have been champion, never was. Rowdy Roddy Piper could have easily been one of the greatest heel champions of all time. As a wrestler, he was okay, he was good, but it wasn't about his wrestling ability, it was about his ability to talk shit and talk smack to people, which Piper was the very best at in his day, and probably one of the best of all time if you made a whole list of top talkers. If he wasn't number one, I think Piper would be in the top 10, probably the top 5. You know, Piper as the heel champion with Hogan chasing him would have been huge, but Hogan was already champion. I guess it didn't make sense to take the title off him at the time. They did a whole bunch of Hogan-Piper matches. They were both in the WrestleMania 1 main event. It just never happened for Piper. Ravishing Rick Rude is another name I don't think gets raised often enough. The more I think about Rude, I think Rude could have had a run as WWE champion. Again, the timing, I guess, just didn't work, because in order for Rude to be the champion, I guess you could have done Hogan Rude in 89, and then when Warrior won the title, that would have been another chance to put the belt on Rude. He did have a title shot against the Ultimate Warrior and didn't win. But, they could have done something like that, maybe, where Rude, who already had one fluke win over Warrior at WrestleMania 5, beat him for the Intercontinental title. Maybe they could have done a story where Rude also beat him in a similar fashion and became WWE champion and let Warrior chase Rude for a few months and get the belt back. I just feel like, again, the timing just wasn't right, because it was very hard to break through to that level, way more hard, it seems, back then than it is today. You know, there were only a very, very select few people that were in that class of being the champion or having a serious shot at becoming the champion back then, and I guess they just didn't look at Rude that way. And Rude was not as big and as jacked up as a lot of those guys were. Savage wasn't either, although I'm sure Savage was jacked up himself, but I don't buy that argument, because Savage was never the biggest guy, and he was champion, and of course Bret Hart came along later on. Bret was never the biggest guy, and they made him the champion. Although by that point, Rude was long gone from WWE. But Rude always had a tremendous physique. It didn't matter to me. You know, you would think it didn't matter that the guy wasn't 300 pounds. The guy was ripped to shreds. He looked phenomenal. I wasn't going to use the word ravishing, because that would have been too corny. But Rick Rude, I think, could have easily been a WWE champion, a heel that somebody chased after. He did have a chance to be champion in WCW later on. Mr. Perfect is another interesting name. I am a Mr. Perfect fan. I'm a big fan of Kurt Hennig's work. I consider him to be one of my favorite people to hold the Intercontinental title. I can go either way on Perfect. I can understand the argument that Perfect wasn't quite at that level, but you know what? Perfect held the AWA title. Perfect was the Intercontinental champion. They obviously saw him, you know, in a certain light. He was a very good worker. He could bump around like nobody's business back then. One of the best at that. And I could see Mr. Perfect as a WWE champion. Maybe not a long reign, but Perfect wins the title and then gets beaten for it by Hogan or somebody. But again, the issue is, how do you get the title on a guy like Perfect? At his peak, the men who were WWE champion when Mr. Perfect was at his peak, arguably, in WWE, were Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior. So, do you have Perfect beat them in a match and then have them chase Perfect for the title? It was just a different time. Because Perfect also, I'm sure if I ever met Mr. Perfect, which I never had the chance to do, I wouldn't probably call him a small man, but he was a small man compared to the monsters that you had on the roster back then, so it was never going to happen. But I think he could have had a run. I think he could have filled that role very, very nicely. And here's another name for you. Vader. When Vader came to WWF in 1996, he was a monster. You know? My favorite incarnation of Vader was in the early 90s, WCW. And he was WCW champion many times over, had a tremendous feud with Sting. He and Sting had some really great matches, some of the best matches, probably next to the Flair ones that Sting ever had in his whole career, were with Big Van Vader. So when Vader first came over to WWF, you remember in the Royal Rumble, 96, he got dumped out, came back in, destroyed everybody, threw Shawn Michaels out, threw all these people out, even though he had already been eliminated. The very next night on Raw, his very first television appearance on Raw, I think he beat Savio Vega in a squash. But then they did the angle with Gorilla Monsoon, who was the president of the WWF at the time, and he beat up Monsoon in one of the best angles in Raw history to this day. You find the footage of that angle. It's a really well-done angle. So at first, they booked Vader to be this reckless, unstoppable monster, and it looked like, okay, give it a few months, 6 months, this guy's going to be champion. I could see Vader being champion with Shawn Michaels chasing him. And there's been a lot of rumors that Vader was supposed to win the title at SummerSlam 96, other rumors that say it was never supposed to happen. I believe Jim Cornette, who managed Vader at the time and did work for WWE, so, you know, not that Jim Cornette wouldn't lie about anything, but he did work for the company, and he said that Vader was supposed to win the championship at some point. I don't know if that would have been SummerSlam or Survivor Series. The plan was always for Shawn to lose the title to somebody at Survivor Series, and according to Cornette, the spot should have been Vader, was supposed to be Vader, and ended up going to Sid instead, with the idea that whoever beat Shawn at Madison Square Garden would then lose the belt back to Shawn in his hometown of San Antonio at the Royal Rumble. So there's one person at least on record as saying Vader was scheduled to be the WWE champion and was not. And him losing to Shawn at SummerSlam that year, I think, hurt him quite a bit. I think if you were going to pull the trigger, not even Survivor Series, I think if you were going to pull the trigger, the time to pull that trigger would have been at SummerSlam, in my opinion. And they didn't do it. And the booking of Vader from that point on into 97, and, I mean, by 98, the guy was just a glorified jobber. They literally had Vader coming out on television calling himself a fat piece of shit. So the de-evolution of Vader on WWE programming was very obvious if you paid any attention. One other name I will throw out there that I don't see mentioned very often, but were he not injured in that horrific car wreck that ultimately, I think it's safe to say, probably led to his demise, probably from all the painkillers and stuff, were it not for him fucking up his ankle the way that he did, I think Brian Pillman, in that loose cannon gimmick, could have been a fine heel WWE champion. I think a Pillman Austin title feud would have been phenomenal stuff. And I think it could have happened, too. Pillman, his whole character, everything, the character he was portraying, it was genius. You really thought this guy was a raving psycho. Of course, he wasn't. But he did a very good job of convincing people through what he did in ECW and when he first came over to WWF that this guy was a tad bit unstable. And before he was injured, Pillman was actually a hell of a wrestler. Remember the Flying Brian days in WCW? That guy could fly. He could go in there and have a great match, and with somebody like Steve Austin, who was on the ascent anyway. Could you imagine the loose cannon character, Brian Pillman, during the Attitude Era in WWE, feuding with Stone Cold Steve Austin? That would have made for some amazing television in the late 90s, and unfortunately we were robbed of it. It was not to be. But those are the men I think of right off the bat when I think of guys who could have been WWE champion, perhaps should have been WWE champion, never had a shot, and it's a shame they didn't. Now, as far as the championship matches, I mean, there's been a ton of great WWE title matches in history. I mean, far too many to go through here. And I was thinking about it, and WWE actually put their own list out. I started thinking about this and putting my own little list together, and then I saw WWE put one up on their website. I think they did the 50 greatest championship matches ever. And you can find it on their website if you want to peruse through it. I mean, it's an interesting list, I will say that. And the number one match on their list, in their opinion, according to the writers at WWE.com, the number one championship match in company history is the Bret Hart-Shawn Michaels Iron Man match from WrestleMania 12. I saw that match live, not live in the arena in Anaheim, but I watched that match on pay-per-view, actually with a whole bunch of friends. And I remember watching that match. I was a lot younger then, too. But even then, I remember watching that match thinking when it was over, that was a really good match, but it was also a boring match. And it was boring, I think, largely because people knew the match was going at least 60 minutes. Like, it's different if you go into a match knowing it's going to go an hour. It takes away, I think, from certainly the fan reaction, because if you go back and watch, like, the first half of that match, I mean, maybe they came alive for certain big moves and spots and stuff like that, but the crowd was dead. It was very quiet. There were a lot of long rest holds and stuff, because you got to, you know, maintain your energy, and you've got to kill time. You've got to drag this thing out for an hour. It's not an easy thing for them to do. And in the end, they had a really good match, but I think maybe announcing the fact that it was going to go 60 minutes instead of just letting them go 60 minutes without anybody knowing in advance, that probably worked against them. I just thought a lot of the match was dull. The real drama picked up at the end because you knew this match was about to end, and it was zero falls apiece. That's what kind of made it exciting at the very end. So I disagree with that ranking. In fact, I don't even rank that in my top 10 greatest WWE Championship matches of all time. I put together a little list here. And I did rank these matches, which is hard to do. I mean, it's such a subjective thing. And again, this is my list. Your list is going to be different than mine. Don't get all up in arms about it. Don't get all pissy. It's just my personal top 10 list of the greatest, or my favorite, I should say, WWE Championship matches in history. Number 10 is a triple threat match, which some of you might be puzzled by, because I've said before that I am not a fan of triple threat matches. I'm not a fan of triple threat main event title match, especially WrestleMania, which thankfully we've only had, I think, one in history actually headline the show, and that was for the World Heavyweight title at the WrestleMania that WWE would rather you forget ever happened. But there was a pay-per-view in 2002 called Vengeance, and there was a main event of Kurt Angle, The Rock, and The Undertaker for Undertaker's Undisputed Championship. I went back and watched that match again recently just because it's been a while since I've seen it, and it holds up very well. It is still probably to this day my favorite triple threat match maybe of any kind, let alone a title match, certainly in WWE. This was about as well-worked a triple threat match as you're ever going to see, because it always follows the same formula, right? The match starts, one guy gets knocked out, these two brawl, then the other guy comes back, somebody else gets knocked out. They kind of follow that formula a bit here, but the match never drags. It never slows down. Just really exciting stuff, and just a really great match, and Rock won the championship. And the very next month, lost the title to Brock Lesnar, which was actually Brock's first title reign. So I put that number 10 on my list. Number 9, Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit, Royal Rumble 2003. This was a tremendous wrestling match. If you're not a fan of like technical wrestling, you probably thought this match was boring as hell. But if you are a fan of actual wrestling, you can't think of two better workers at that time to step in the ring against each other than Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit. They've had so many matches together. This was probably the best match the two ever had. So good that even in defeat, when the match was over, the crowd gave Benoit a standing ovation, which is my lasting memory from that match, was Benoit getting all emotional in the middle of the ring as the crowd gave him a standing ovation. So, just a fantastic title match. So that's number 9. Number 8, Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior, WrestleMania 6. There's a match that probably a lot of people didn't think was going to be as good as it was. At my age back then, I had no concept of any of that, because when you're a kid, you can be stupid and just enjoy it for what it is, right? And I do think a lot of times grown adults should probably act the same way in that respect. Just enjoy it for what it is. Don't knock it. You know, it's hard to do, though, because you get older, your interests change, right? You're not into the bread and butter baby face anymore. Maybe now you like the bad guys, or you cast a critical eye about this and that because now you're looking more at work rate. That was a really great match, or that match sucked. You just look at things differently as you get older. You can't avoid it. Plus, again, now you have the internet. Back then you didn't, but it was a really good match, all things considered, especially by the standards of Ultimate Warrior matches, because Warrior had to be in there with a guy who really knew how to wrestle a great match in order to have a great match, and Randy Savage had the best match that Warrior had in his entire career with him. Both guys deserve a lot of credit for that, but Savage, I mean, let's be honest, Savage had a lot to do with that. Hogan held his own in this match. These guys busted out some moves I don't think that either one of us have seen them do very often, and they did all their signature moves. There was a big ref bump in the middle of the match. Fans were into it. They actually, off that ref bump, had a great near fall that was so close, the fans exploded because I think they thought it was a count of three, And back then, there was like one video screen, I think, up in the entire, you know, dome. It was at the Sky Dome in Toronto. You didn't have HD monitors all over the place so you can see exactly what happened. The finish was also very clever. Hogan goes for his leg drop, which he rarely, if ever, missed. In fact, I don't think as a fan back then I ever remember Hogan missing the leg drop in a match. And he missed it here. And Ultimate Warrior covered him, got the pin, won the championship. And after the match, Hogan handed him the title, walked off. And Ultimate Warrior had his big pyro celebration at the end of WrestleMania 6. So it was very unique because you didn't really see babyface versus babyface matches very often back then, let alone in a WrestleMania main event. And Hogan had had tremendous success at WrestleMania up until that point, although he went to a draw with Andre at WrestleMania 4, but that's, you know, it's not a loss, really. And they had a tremendous match at WrestleMania 6, one that people still remember today. So I certainly do. That's number 8 on my list. Number 7, Shawn Michaels and Mankind. At Mind Games in Your House, 1996. Talk about a clash in styles. Michaels was a high flyer, kind of a finesse wrestler, as Jim Ross would say. I love that word, finesse. Mankind, when I think of the word finesse, I don't think of Mankind. I think of brute. I think of a lot of things, actually, when I think of Mankind. I think dirty. I think disgusting. I think brawler. Foley as a brawler was great. Michaels, in my opinion, as a brawler, showed what he's capable of in the match with Diesel. Diesel had a false count, not false count anywhere, he had a no-holds-barred match with Michaels the month after Michaels won the belt. That was Diesel's final pay-per-view match in WWE. And they had a great brawl. They had a great brawl with prosthetic limbs and all this stuff. It was a crazy match. So this wasn't the first time we got to see Shawn Michaels, right, the big dancing babyface in 96, show off his brawling skills, but he certainly showed them off here, and they worked very well together. It was a real hard-hitting match. At one point, Mankind was stabbing himself in the leg with something to try to get feeling back into his leg. I think Jim Ross pointed that out on commentary back when they had the three-man booth of Ross, Lawler, and McMahon. It was a great match. The finish, it was some disqualification finish. Vader did a run-in. So, not the best finish in the world. I guess they wanted to protect Mankind at that time. Mankind had come in very strongly at the time. He had two big wins over The Undertaker, and I can't think of very many people back then who got clean wins, basically, over The Undertaker. Clean isn't the right word, because both times, I think Paul Bearer hit Undertaker maybe by accident in the first match with the urn, and then turned on him in the second match, but Mankind had a lot of momentum, and I guess they just didn't want to kill the momentum by beating him clean here, so it was a DQ finish. Even with the DQ finish, it didn't matter. This was a great match. Probably the match of the year in 1996. I would rank that even ahead of the Iron Man match. So that's number 7 on the list here. Number 6, Stone Cold Steve Austin against Dude Love, Over the Edge, 1998. This is one of my favorite matches ever. And you might ask yourself, why? A Dude Love match? Why? Why would that be your favorite match? Because this match is everything pro wrestling should be. It's not just a straight, you know, it's a great wrestling match. This was a brawl. Again, these two guys were brawlers. Austin and Foley were brawlers. So they brawled all over the place. They brawled in the ring. They brawled out of the ring. They brawled up the entranceway. At that pay-per-view, they happened to have as part of the set these beat-up old cars, I guess, that were just there. They brawled on the cars. At one point, I think Austin did a backdrop. I think he backdropped Foley. He took a flat back bump onto the concrete, which, you could tell by the way Mick Foley moves around these days, he's probably taking quite a few flat back bumps onto concrete and maybe regrets doing that, or maybe he doesn't, I don't know. So the match itself was exciting. They went back and forth. It was a fight. They had Vince McMahon in there wearing the absolute tightest t-shirt, tightest referee shirt, I should say, that you've ever seen in your life. I think Mick Foley on one of the DVDs that this match is on actually jokes. He wants to know what five-year-old Vince bummed that shirt off of. It was so tight. And Vince was so ridiculously jacked for a guy who, up until only a few months before, a lot of people only knew as an announcer. He was the referee in this match. The story they told here was excellent. The deck was being stacked against Steve Austin. You had Vince McMahon, who hated Austin, as the special referee for the match. You had Gerald Briscoe at ringside, as well as Pat Patterson, both of whom, one was the ring announcer, Patterson was the ring announcer, Briscoe was the timekeeper, and so there were points in the match where both guys were, you know, counted out, or they should have been counted out, and then they said, no, this match is now no count out. And then it became, no, this match is no disqualification. They did everything in their power to try to screw over Steve Austin and get the championship off of him and get the title off Dude Love. And it didn't work. Undertaker had volunteered to be at ringside to make sure that Austin didn't get screwed. And he factored into the end of the match, which was an amazing sequence. Okay, the reaction that Austin would get back then was just unreal. And I want to say they were in Green Bay for that match, because I remember Jim Ross alluding to that on commentary. And the crowd in Green Bay, actually, Jim Ross did say that. He said, Austin gets a bigger reaction in Green Bay than Brett Favre, which was probably bullshit. And Vince McMahon took a very sick chair shot straight to the skull towards the end of the match. Place exploded. Austin gave Dude Love a stunner. The place came unglued. Now there's no referee. A ref runs down. Patterson drags him out, knocks him out. So now Patterson goes to count the fall, with Foley having Austin in the mandible claw. His shoulders are down. Undertaker pulls Patterson out, choke slams him through the announce table. Now Briscoe runs in to count the fall, and as Jim Ross was... You want an illustration of how fucking awesome Jim Ross was in situations like this in terms of ramping up the drama? Go back and watch this match and listen to the commentary. Briscoe goes to run in, and Jim Ross is like, there goes Briscoe now! And then Undertaker grabs him. He's like, well, here comes Briscoe now! And Briscoe took a funny-looking bump through the other announce table, which just sort of collapsed under his weight. And place is just going out of their skin at this point. People are jumping around, they're screaming, they're shouting, they're smiling. Austin gives Dude Love a low blow, kicks him in the balls, stunner. Vince is out. Austin drags him over, grabs his hand, because remember, going into this match, Vince McMahon had said that the only fall that would be counted in this match will come by my hand. And that played into the finish. He said, by my hand. So Austin grabbed his hand, and using Vince's hand, he counted the three. And a bloody Austin, you know, celebrates with the championship after the match, and they started teasing a match down the road with him and Undertaker at that point, which would come at SummerSlam. But, I remember that match like it was yesterday. From the crowd reaction, to the brawling, to the drama, to the interference, the ref bump, I mean, everything. Everything about that match was so much fun, which is what wrestling should be. Wrestling should be fun. And that match is, anytime I do any sort of list like this, that match has to make the list because it's just that much fun. Number five, Randy Savage and Ric Flair. WrestleMania 8. I loved everything about this match, including the post-match stuff. The post-match stuff was almost as good, if not better, than the match itself. The story going into that match was, she was mine before she was yours. That was the whole storyline with Ric Flair saying, your wife, Elizabeth, she was with me before she was ever with you. And they were going to reveal very provocative photos, a centerfold of Elizabeth, to the world. They were going to drop the centerfold down from the roof of the Hoosier Dome if Flair won the match, which he didn't, so we never did get to see that centerfold, unfortunately. I remember in the WWF magazine at the time, they even had these doctored-looking photos of Ric Flair posing by poolside with Liz, watching a movie with Liz, shooting pool with Liz. And then later on, they did this whole expose in the magazine showing it was actually Randy Savage in the... They really went above and beyond with these storylines back then, and it helped sell the match. And the match itself was very good. Savage got a roll-up with the trunks to win, and after the match was over, Savage is hurt. He's in the corner. Elizabeth is in there celebrating. And Elizabeth had come down midway through the match because he didn't want her down there. She came down halfway through. Randy was in a lot of trouble. If you pay any attention, when the referees came out to try to bring Liz back to the locker room, one of the young officials who ran out to try to stop her was a young Shane McMahon. Liz would have none of this. She wanted to stay at ringside. So she's in the ring now. Flair spins her around. And Flair's yelling at her, saying, what about me? What about me? Flair's got half his head, half of his white hair is blood red. And he grabs Elizabeth, and he forces a kiss on her. And Elizabeth smacks the shit out of Flair. And you got 62,000 people in the Hoosier Dome going nuts. Savage comes from out of nowhere like a raging bull. Just absolutely goes after Ric Flair in a vicious rage. Referees are everywhere. Referees were being thrown aside. Mr. Perfect is in there now. He's hitting Savage, and Flair's pushing refs around. And it was a really wild brawl at the end of that match. And then Savage's promo afterwards where he just lost it when he realized what Flair had done to his wife. I love that whole storyline. I love this match. Really great stuff. And it's been a long time, in my opinion, since we've had a championship match at a WrestleMania that had the kind of emotion that match had in 92. Number four, Steve Austin and The Rock, WrestleMania X7. Probably the biggest match. Not probably, the biggest match the two of them ever had. And my favorite of the three, they had one WrestleMania 15, which is a close second. WrestleMania 17, WrestleMania 19, which I wasn't as much of a fan of. But this was the match that some people might say ended the Attitude Era. This was the final match of the Golden Age before Steve Austin turned heel and shook Vince McMahon's hand. But you had everything in this match. You had good action. You had guys. I mean, I remember Steve Austin busting out the old, you know, million-dollar dream sleeper hold that Ted DiBiase taught him in this match. And they were using sharpshooters. Both guys were bloodied. And then, of course, when Vince came out, it was Vince doing everything he could to help Austin win. Austin was going to do whatever it was to win the championship, win at all costs, which he did, and then came the heel turn when the match was over. One of the more memorable matches and finishes, certainly in WWE history. Number three, John Cena and CM Punk, Money in the Bank, 2011. Yes, John Cena is in my personal top three WWE Championship matches list of all time. That's going to just infuriate some people, but I don't care, because this was a fantastic match. I cannot think of another match in the last 10 years in WWE that had the sort of investment from a crowd. And in turn, because they were so into it, I think people watching at home were so into it, than this match. And the match went, it was pretty long. I mean, it went about 35, 40 minutes, I think. You had Vince come out with Laurinaitis at the end. Laurinaitis tried to interfere. Cena knocked him down. And when Cena went back in the ring, Punk gave him the GTS and pinned him and became WWE champion for the very first time. But it was all about that Chicago crowd. If that match were held anywhere else, I don't think people would remember it as fondly as they do. Because I know I'm not the only one. You know, they had a whole bunch of great matches. I mean, Cena and Punk have great chemistry together. That match they had on Raw, you know, back in February with the pile driver, awesome stuff. But this is the match I'll always remember between these two guys. And so that's number three on the list. Number two, Bret Hart and Owen Hart. Steel cage match, SummerSlam, 1994. Kind of like the Flair Savage match at WrestleMania, it was the post-match stuff that also helped put this over the top because it was the culmination of the family feud rivalry. I mean, Bret and Owen would have a whole bunch more matches in 94-95, but they had the match at WrestleMania 10. Owen won. And because Bret went on to win the championship, it made sense that Owen deserved a title shot. He beat Bret before he won the title. Give me a title shot. So they did the match in a cage, and at ringside were Hart family members just sitting in a section. It was I don't know if Stu and Helen were there. I can't remember, but the brothers and the sisters were there. Jim the Anvil Neidhart was also there. British Bulldog, who I think had just made a return to the company, he was sitting in the front row with his wife, Diana. This was still when Bulldog had the long hair. So you have the whole Hart family at ringside, and Bret and Owen go in this cage, and they have what to this day is my favorite steel cage match in wrestling history. Of all the cage matches I've ever seen, and there have been a lot of great cage matches. I'm not talking Hell in a Cell. I'm talking steel cage matches. It was a great wrestling match inside a steel cage. There was no blood. That is true. But it's just two brothers who hated each other's guts, beating the piss out of each other. There was one sequence that I loved where Owen kept going for the door. He would drag Bret away and literally make a lunge, a mad dash for the door. And Bret would pull him, then Bret would try to go out. And then it got to a point where Bret was like, fuck this shit. He dragged Owen in and just started pummeling the hell out of him. Just little things like that. And when the match was over, Bret won. And that's when everything went to hell. Because Jim Neidhart attacked the Bulldog. Bulldog was in the front row. And Anvil comes up from behind, clotheslines him. And what ended up happening is Bulldog ended up falling over the barricade with his wife. His wife basically took a bump also. And Anvil goes in the cage, locks himself in there, which was funny because he was having trouble getting the padlock on, and so all the family members outside had to basically stand there and watch as he fumbled around and tried to lock the door. So he locked himself in, which, again, there's no top on the cage. So you have all these Hart family members and the Bulldog, everyone trying to climb in, and I think Anvil maybe, I don't know if he threw his shoe or his shoe got taken off at one point in the escape. I don't know what happened, but it was just complete mayhem and pandemonium at the end of this match. And my favorite of the Bret Owen matches, even more so than WrestleMania 10. Number one, this kind of skewed the list, I guess. Maybe I could have left this off the list, but to give others a chance. But the 1992 Royal Rumble match. I've made no bones about the fact that this is my favorite Royal Rumble of all time. It's a lot of people's favorite Royal Rumble match. It will never be topped. It was just a phenomenally well-laid-out match. Ric Flair coming out at number three, and as Gorilla Monsoon pointed out early on, no man up to that point had ever, in the history of the Rumble event, drawn numbers 1 through 5 and been there at the end. He didn't even say win, just be there at the end of the match. And Flair went on to win. He went 62 minutes. Some people say the real time was 59. Doesn't matter. He was in there for over an hour. And there were so many little stories in that Rumble match that they told. The main story, of course, was Flair. Flair coming in early and having to outlast all of these other men. And at one point, he cleared the ring. And he kind of had a few moments to breathe, and then the buzzer hit, and out comes Rowdy Roddy Piper. Now, you have to remember, when Flair first came into WWF, it wasn't as though it was all about Flair Hogan. Yes, the two of them were on a collision course, and they did that one funeral parlor segment together, but Flair also feuded with Roddy Piper. It's almost like he had different feuds going on simultaneously. Pissed off a lot of people when he first came in. So here comes Piper, and Flair has this look on his face like, oh, shit. And Bobby Heenan the same way on commentary. So now he's got to put up with Piper. And then the ring would fill up again. And everybody was trying to get rid of Ric Flair. Everybody was trying to dump him out. At the same time, you had all these other stories as well. You had Jake the Snake and Macho Man, who were in the middle of a blood feud at that time. And Jake was in the ring, and later on when Savage came out, Savage just bolted for the ring, and Jake must have slipped out because when Savage got in there, he couldn't find him. And then we saw that Jake had retreated to the outside. So we had that little side story going on. Then Hogan came in later on. Hogan had won back-to-back Royal Rumbles, and a lot of people probably thought he would have three-peated here and won the championship. And that was the other element, too. This was the first and, to date, the only Royal Rumble match in history for the championship. The title was vacant. So the winner of the Royal Rumble was going to be the WWE champion. I can't understand why they never did that again. There was a Rumble a few years ago, in fact, that I thought would have been perfect for them to have, you know, a vacant championship on the line of the Rumble. But the problem is, you almost can't even do that now because you've got two world titles. So how do you decree that in the Royal Rumble, only the WWE championship is on the line, you know, and not the world heavyweight title? So in a way, they can't even really do it now. But to date, it's the only Rumble that ever had that stipulation to it. This is the finish with Hogan being dumped by Sid Justice, Hogan being a big crybaby, trying to pull Sid out of the ring. Flair comes up from behind, dumps him out. He survives. Bobby Heenan goes ape shit. You know, I told you so. I told you so. Everything about that Rumble was pitch perfect. It's the best Rumble in history. And because it was for the championship, that makes it the best WWE championship match of all time. Find me another championship match that told the kind of stories that this match told and had the kind of performances, or in the case of Flair, performance, singular. You can't. It was just great stuff. So that would be my personal list if I had to rank 10 WWE title matches in a list. Those are the 10 that would be on my list. When I put the Rumble on there, which I did not originally include the Rumble, I was going to actually put that on there as kind of a, like an asterisk almost. On my original list, I had another match, which was Triple H and The Rock from Backlash 2000. Not their Iron Man match the next month, but the Backlash 2000 match, which was the match where Rock did win the championship, unlike at WrestleMania. And Steve Austin came out and killed everybody with chair shots, and Rock got the big pin at the end. I'll give that an honorable mention here. But that's my list. Let me know what you think, what your feedback is, and what your list would look like. I want to move on here to Impact Wrestling really quick because we're going way over time and I got a lot of mailbag questions to get to, so we'll run right through this. Impact from Thursday night, just to go through some of this stuff here. They're still doing the storyline stuff with James Storm and AJ Styles. AJ was in the crowd again doing the Sting gimmick, and Storm was cutting a promo on him, and Bad Influence came out. They tried to reform Fortune throughout this entire show. They tried to convince James Storm to join up with them. He wouldn't. Later on, they tried to convince Bobby Roode to join up with them. He wouldn't. So much for the Fortune reunion. But Aces and Eights came out, killed James Storm. AJ didn't help. And it was funny because Mr. Anderson tried to give James Storm a powerbomb. And he had him in the powerbomb position for so long because apparently Joseph Park was late in running out to make the save, which eventually he finally did, so that looked kind of weird. And the Dudleys put Joseph Park through the table with a 3D, which, according to Bully, was the first 3D through a table in over 2 years. And the point of all this was for Bully Ray to challenge Hulk Hogan to meet him face-to-face later in the show. In fact, that's what this entire show on Thursday was built around. Hulk Hogan. So we had two knockouts matches on this show, which is some kind of record, I think. I can't remember the last time we saw two Divas matches on Raw. It's hard to figure out the last time we saw one Divas match on Raw. I guess we had the Battle Royal for Monday. Taryn Terrell pinned Tara in the first of these two knockouts matches. The other one was a championship match with Mickie James challenging Velvet Sky in a match that had a ridiculous amount of heat. I couldn't tell if maybe there was a fight somewhere in the crowd that we couldn't see, and that's why the people were so loud, but I guess they were just really into this match. It was actually kind of refreshing to see a crowd react to a women's match like this, and it was a pretty long match, too, over 10 minutes. And think about that for a second. The women on Impact Thursday got a total between those two matches of nearly 20 minutes of in-ring action. That is amazing. And it wasn't always pretty. I'm not saying it was very good. The finish was Velvet Sky winning with a cradle in the corner, which, unfortunately, the cradle was so close to the ropes that it almost messed up the whole finish. But anyway, it sure felt like a heel turn is coming with Mickie James if you watch this match. They didn't do much to tease it when the match was over. They just kind of cut away almost instantly. So much for giving these things time to breathe. They aired a vignette hyping the return of Chris Sabin coming up this Thursday. He blew both of his ACLs out in the span of a year, his left one and his right one. So I'm sure I won't be the only one holding my breath on Impact this week for the first time he goes for a flying move of any kind. I know it's a tape show, and I didn't read the spoilers. I assume if he had gotten hurt, I would have heard about it by now. So that's a good sign. It's just too bad Alex Shelley is no longer with TNA, because I did enjoy the Motor City Machine Guns tag team. Speaking of tag teams, Hernandez and Chavo beat Bobby Roode and Austin Aries to retain their tag team titles. These two teams work very well together, but I am very much over seeing this match. We've seen this a million times. The Bad Influence, Bobby Roode, Austin Aries feud is still alive. Bad Influence was at ringside. Chris Daniels was on headset doing commentary. They interfered in the match, which backfired on them. And ultimately, it cost Roode and Aries the match. So at least we're finally getting that Bad Influence, Roode Aries feud. It's about time. I don't know what you do with Chavo and Hernandez now, though. But I take it makes sense to probably just have Aces and Eights put two of their guys up against them and take the titles. Maybe Bischoff and Briscoe. Not that I'm advocating that, but I could see that happening. They showed highlights of a TNA press conference to promote their upcoming show in South Florida. The event was held at Hulk Hogan's restaurant down there. They showed some new football coach being handed a replica TNA belt. That's all well and good, but I was very disappointed that they did not show you the Aces and Eights run-in that happened during this press conference. Apparently, Aces and Eights showed up to crash the party, and later they escaped into the bay on jet skis. I shit you not, this really happened. There was a newspaper article about the whole thing. I linked to it on my Twitter page. Jet skis. Now that I would have loved to have seen, so naturally they didn't show it. I did think it reminded me a bit of that Cheat 'em the Midget skit that WCW did back in the day when I heard about the jet ski part. There was this horrific skit, which I think I've talked about before, where Vader and Sid, the heels, had this little midget dude plant a bomb on a boat that Sting and Davey Boy Smith were supposed to be on, and the heels' plan was foiled, and the babyfaces all celebrated in the end. It's the stuff of wrestle crap legend. You should look it up. Somebody else on Twitter actually said it reminded them of Hulk Hogan's old show Thunder in Paradise, which actually I had forgotten about. That's an awesome comparison. I used to watch that show. Wasn't bad. Matt Morgan came out to bore everyone to sleep. He's still rambling on and on about all the mistakes that Hulk Hogan has made as the GM. So naturally, he calls out Hulk Hogan, the man he's been insulting for the past several months and pointing out all of his flaws and all of his inaccurate decisions and awful decisions. He calls out Hogan to ask for a title shot at Slammiversary. This is not sound strategy if one wants to convince upper management to grant them a championship match. And Hogan declined his offer and said he would face Bully himself later in the show, not in a match, but face-to-face, And then he said he doesn't remember Andre the Giant ever coming out and crying like a bitch. And then he left. Hogan also doesn't remember that Andre was, in fact, not 700 pounds when he slammed him in the Silverdome. So I would not trust Hogan's memory too much. You, the fans, get to vote who you would like to see compete in an upcoming X Division Contenders match, we were told. The choices are Rashad Cameron, Rockstar Spud, and Suicide. Frankie Kazarian played Suicide for the first time they did the gimmick. I wonder if they'd let him play the role again. Then they could bring back Curry Man. Let Christopher Daniels and Kazarian wrestle each other under masks. They can be rivals in the ring while in costume and then best friends without the costume. Anyway, I think you can text your vote and they'll announce the winner on next week's show. Match itself takes place on Impact May 23rd. Bully Ray came out for the main event, last segment, his confrontation with Hulk Hogan. He rattled off all the names of the TNA babyfaces that Aces and Eights have destroyed in recent months, and it's quite the list. You've got Sting, Kurt Angle, Jeff Hardy, who they're now teasing his career may be over as a result of Bully smashing him in the head with that hammer, which, by wrestling standards, should really require nothing more than a Band-Aid and some Motrin, so man up would be my advice. Samoa Joe, Magnus, Eric Young, James Storm, Joseph Park, just a laundry list of names that Aces and Eights have killed. Hulk Hogan comes down, and Bully starts insulting him. The fans start doing the what chant because they're mentally defective. I mean, they're from Indiana, Pennsylvania. They can't make up their minds which state they live in. How bright can they possibly be? I kid the folks in Indiana, Pennsylvania. I don't want to get rude emails now from people who live there. I'm sure they're lovely people in Indiana, Pennsylvania. Bully spit in Hulk Hogan's face. Hogan turned his back in shame. Then ripped off his shirt. He hulked up. He nailed Bully with three punches and the champion bailed out of the ring. Aces and Eights came out. They surrounded the ring. The lights went out. When they came back on, there was Sting with the baseball bat in his hand, pointing it at Hulk Hogan. I guess teasing that maybe he had joined these evildoers in Aces and Eights. But then Sting turned his bat on Bully Ray. Aces and Eights attacked, and Sting and Hogan beat all of them up. Eight men, or seven, I guess, since Bully had bailed out of there. But Sting and Hulk Hogan did what Kurt Angle, Jeff Hardy, Samoa Joe, James Storm, Magnus, and others could not. They beat up the Aces and Eights. And then, after vanquishing their enemy, Sting pointed the bat at Hogan one more time, and then he walked back up the ramp. All I can say to this is I cannot wait to see what happens next week on Thunder. Let's go to the mailbag. If you have questions, comments, shout-outs, or any of that stuff, you could email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. And speak of the devil, we start this week with a WCW question. How ironic. Keith from Kentucky. We know many of the reasons WCW went under. Perhaps their downfall was inevitable, but if you could go back to one moment in time and make one change to WCW to give it the best chance of staying alive today, what would it be? Do you book a certain match differently, fire someone, try to hire someone? What would you do? This is an impossible question to answer, because I don't think changing any one single thing would have made the difference. You know, it was a bunch of different things. The AOL Time Warner merger certainly did them no favors, but it's also overplayed, I think, by guys like Kevin Nash, who, whenever I hear him in interviews, he likes to say that is what led to the company's downfall, which is misleading. I mean, actually, the man most responsible for the death of WCW was a Turner executive named Jamie Kellner, who wanted nothing to do with wrestling, and he canceled all of WCW's programming, which left them with no TV network. But as far as the things I would or would not have done, I never would have had Kevin Nash be the one to end Goldberg's streak. I never would have let guys like Jericho and Benoit and Eddie Guerrero leave. I would have tried to do a better job of pushing at least some of those guys into more prominent positions. I'm not saying that Eddie Guerrero should have been WCW champion at some point. I think Jericho or Benoit could have been, and Benoit was. Benoit was made a WCW champion towards the end, but it was largely just done to make him happy because they knew he wanted out. It never should have gotten to that point in the first place. I never would have allowed the NWO to become as bloated as it did with guys like Vincent and Brian Adams and Scott Norton. No offense to Scott Norton, who was a big, tough dude, but he didn't belong in the NWO. I never would have had the babyfaces look as inferior as they did to the NWO for so long, which ultimately bit them on the ass. I mean, I think the only babyface that they allowed to get one over on the NWO other than, you know, Sting, obviously, they did the whole Sting storyline, and Sting would fight them off with a bat and everything like that. And there were moments of hope when somebody like a Savage or a Giant would fight back and stuff. But the one that really sticks out to me, I will say, and this was to WCW's credit, was Diamond Dallas Page. DDP and Goldberg may have been the only legit names that were really made, big names that were made during those years in WCW in the late 90s. And Page, you know, it was largely a favor from his friend Scott Hall, who they put him over big time on that one Nitro episode when Page was teasing joining the group, the thing with the t-shirt, remember? And then he ended up giving him a diamond cutter and ran off into the crowd to celebrate with the people. That got the whole People's Champ gimmick for DDP started up. That was big-time stuff there. That's to WCW's credit, but we saw very little of that. We saw way more babyfaces get their asses kicked with no comeback than the opposite. And like I said, in the end, long-term, it came back to bite them on the ass. I would not have given away so many pay-per-view caliber matches on free television like they did with that first Goldberg-Hogan match. Goldberg and Hogan, one of the more memorable matches in WCW history, came 6 days before their Bash at the Beach pay-per-view, where Goldberg ended up defending his newly won title against Kurt Hennig, of all people. And Kurt Hennig was not exactly booked to be a main event guy at that time in WCW, but they needed somebody to step in there and fight him for the championship. Actually, that might have been the match that was originally on the card, but now that Goldberg was champion, it was going to be for the title. Meanwhile, guess who headlined that pay-per-view after having just lost the world title less than a week earlier? Hulk Hogan. They had executives, apparently, from Turner Broadcasting in the Georgia Dome for Nitro that night, and I guess they wanted to give them a big main event to impress them. How'd that work out for them? You know, and there's another point to consider here also, is how notoriously horrible WCW was at merchandising, especially as compared to WWE. When it came to t-shirts and videos, DVDs, good luck finding any. If they would have been more efficient in that department, I'm not saying that alone would have saved the company, but they had to be losing millions of dollars when it came to merchandising potential. Had to be. I remember going into my local Blockbuster Video back in the day, and in the sports section, you've got rows of WWF VHS tapes, the most recent pay-per-views. You've got some compilation best-of videos there, like the Coliseum home video type stuff, and rarely, if ever, would I see a WCW tape in there. And that was during their peak, when they were on top, kicking ass, in 97-98. So, there's no single good answer to your question. WCW had a relatively quick rise after the start of the Monday Night War. Less than a year later, the NWO angle was in full force and catching fire. They had two, maybe two and a half, really big years on top. And then they had a spectacular crash and burn. And there's a lot of reasons why that was. You can't narrow it down to just one. Sean Masterson writes in, "Reason I'm contacting you is because of a recent article I read on Bleacher Report regarding WrestleMania 29 doing record business for the company. Was it really Rock vs. John Cena that drew fans in, or was it Punk vs. Taker? Surely the rest of the Mania card also plays its part in drawing. Also, didn't WWE jack up the pay-per-view price this year? That has to count for some extra revenue. Personally, I watched because of Punk Taker. Curious if Ryback could shell-shock Mark Henry, Fandango, and Big E's debuts. And, of course, the Shield's first WrestleMania match as well." Well, I also was looking forward to the Shield's match at WrestleMania, but that didn't draw that number. Nor did Fandango, or Big E Langston, or Ryback and Mark Henry. The first thing to consider is WrestleMania is always going to do big no matter what, because it's WrestleMania. It's always going to draw. Second, you are right, they did increase the price this year, at least for the HD feed they did. I think it was something like $70, which is just ridiculous. I don't even know that the biggest boxing matches are $70 right now. Third and most important are the fact that they had three men on this show. The Rock, Brock Lesnar, and The Undertaker. Because The Undertaker is at a point now where he is a special attraction. And I think with the right opponent and the right match, he could be a big draw. Undertaker alone and the streak will not bring in 1.1 million pay-per-view buys or gross $70 million, but all three of those guys being on the show, and more importantly, let's be honest here, Brock Lesnar and The Rock being on that show is what helped big time. Has nothing to do with The Shield, has nothing to do with Fandango, has nothing to do with Ryback and Mark Henry. That's just the way it is. Barry writes in, want to say thanks for helping me get votes in the TNA Gut Check Challenge. I won my round and now advance to the final round of the top 16. Voting will begin for that in June. So good luck to Barry. Glad we could all help. Barry once appeared on SmackDown last year as an enhancement guy that got fed to Ryback in one of those two-on-one handicap matches. He says, at one point in WWE, the World Heavyweight Championship meant something, and it was defended in the main event of several WrestleManias. When did this belt start losing its value? At one point, it seemed like the World Heavyweight title was on the same level, if not higher, than the WWE title. I'm pretty sure that when the World title was prominently featured like that, it was on Raw. It was the Raw title. And the WWE Championship was on SmackDown, like it was when JBL, for example, had that long reign as champion, and then he dropped the title to John Cena. That was a SmackDown feud, because it was on the SmackDown brand, and that's why it was secondary. So I think a lot of that just had to do with the world title being on Raw. Once the world title wasn't officially the Raw belt anymore, because Raw is the A-show, it lost a lot of that prestige. Eric writes in, his 21st birthday was yesterday on April 27th. He was hoping for a shout-out. So there you go, Eric. I hope you can still remember your birthday last night. If not, that is the sign of a good night right there. Unless your name is Rosa Mendez, then it's not. Alexander also celebrated a birthday on the 27th, and he has a question. Do you think WWE will ever hold WrestleMania in an arena again? Also, I remember Ryback teasing on Twitter that he was the one to debut, or that was going to debut, I guess, in the 2:21:11 vignettes instead of The Undertaker. Do you think back then would have been a more opportune time for Ryback to make his debut? First, I don't think we've seen the last of WrestleMania in Madison Square Garden. I can't predict when they'll be back there, but I do believe that they will at least be back there somewhere down the road. So yes, I do believe that we will have at least one more arena WrestleMania at some point in the future. And also, who's to say 5 years from now that business cools down to a point where they can't fill the big stadiums anymore? I don't think they're going to have that problem. I think they're here to stay for the most part. But I do think that there could be a chance at some point when they come back to New York, they want to do something special with the Garden, and they make an exception. So I think it'll happen. As far as your second question, no, it was not an opportune time. I believe, first of all, Ryback was still not fully recovered from his ankle injury. I could be wrong about that. So despite whatever he may have been teasing on Twitter at the time, I don't think he was 100% ready to come back. He was out a long time after he broke his ankle. Something like a year and a half, I think, or something like that. And more importantly, you'd still need at least a few months to build him up as a big deal like they did last year with him. Months and months of handicap squash matches. If he debuted on TV in February of 2011, and they don't even like debuting new people right before WrestleMania, which is another consideration to be made here. That's a different story, though. But let's say if they debuted him on television in February of 2011, and they take a few months to build him up, once June and July rolls around, and WWE is doing everything in their power to keep CM Punk happy and keep him under contract, Ryback falls victim to Punk the same way he did last year. You know, they felt they couldn't put the title, or they didn't want to put the title on him because they had a long-term plan in place with The Rock. They wanted Punk to have a much longer reign, drop the championship to Rock at the Rumble, 434 days, and so the timing just wasn't right. Maybe if that wasn't the plan, maybe they would have said, hey, let's put the title on Ryback. So much like last year, the timing in 2011 would have been all screwed up, so I don't think it would have been a good time for that. This comes from Corey. Do you think it would have been a smarter decision on WWE's part to put the new title on Brock Lesnar, putting him over CM Punk instead of The Rock going over on him, since Brock doesn't have a movie schedule and WWE could have booked him on more Raws than Rock? Also, do you think WWE putting the title on Lesnar within the next year would be a good idea, possibly leading up to a championship main event with Rock at WrestleMania 30. I say no on both. Brock is a heel, so him against Punk right now would not make any sense. Plus, it's not as though WWE can just snap their fingers and add dates to Brock's contract whenever they want to, you know, just because he's not making movies. Brock has a set number of dates that he can appear, as designated by his contract. WWE, I would imagine, can inquire about adding dates if Brock's okay with that, but they'd probably have to pay through the nose. And quite frankly, I don't think Brock wants the extra travel. As far as him and Rock for the title next year, absolutely not. They don't need a title on the line. It's a big enough match where you could get two big matches at WrestleMania next year. You do Rock versus Brock, and then you put the title on the line in a different match. Plus, we don't need any more part-timers as champion. It worked with Rock. I had no problem with it. But now that it's over, it's run its course. You know, they need somebody who will be on the road full-time for them holding the strap. Brock is not full-time. He never will be. All right, let's squeeze in two more here. Matt I writes in, can you give a shout-out to my wonderful fiance Ashley? About a month ago, she bought my brother and I tickets to WWE Payback in June. It came as a total surprise, and I just want to publicly thank her on the sound-off. What are your thoughts on Marty Wright, a.k.a. Boogeyman, in WWE? More specifically, can you talk about the worms? It's pretty obvious the guy ate real worms. Was that his idea or creatives, and is it true that he actually used to get sick from them? Finally, what happened to the Boogeyman? Did he quit or get released? By all accounts, it was his idea. He was eating worms in real life, even before he played the Boogeyman on TV, or so he claims. He claimed they were high in protein, so there you go. As far as him getting sick, I remember hearing one writer who used to be with WWE in an interview, I can't remember where, talking about how Boogeyman was in the emergency room quite a few times because he had, stomach pains or whatever, and they found he had a lot of bacteria in his stomach, the kind that you would only get from eating worms. So say what you want to about Boogeyman as a wrestler, because he wasn't very good, but boy, did that guy take that gimmick seriously or what? He actually got released both times. He got released once by WWE. They brought him back pretty quickly. And the last time he was in the company under contract, they released him. So he never quit. Both times he got let go. Last time we saw him was actually on TV a few months ago when he made that cameo during the Slammy Awards. So he's still around. Who knows when he may pop up again. Michael writes in, who would you least like to encounter in a dark alleyway at night and why? Mark Henry, Brock Lesnar, Batista, or Ryback? Brock Lesnar. I mean, hands down. I mean, did you not see him teleport from the inside of the ring to the outside 2 weeks ago when he destroyed Heath Slater? The dude is freaky fast. I would never be able to outrun the man. If he chased after me, I would be doomed. At least I think with Mark Henry and Batista, I think I would have a shot of outrunning them. But Brock Lesnar? No way. If you have questions for the mailbag, keep sending them on in. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. is the email address for any and all inquiries, questions, comments, shout-outs, and all that good stuff. You could also follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is the handle on there. We're tweeting up a storm usually during the week. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is the official Facebook profile page. Send me a friend request. I will approve you. Also, don't forget you can subscribe to this show in iTunes. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. You can do the same thing now in the Google Play Store. For those of you with Android devices, Sound Off is now an actual app for Android. So go ahead and find it, download it, leave a review for it if you have a few moments. And you could also visit the Solomonster.com, thesolomonster.com, for archives of all the shows and to make a PayPal donation to the show, which I would very much appreciate. So that's going to do it for this week's episode of The Sound Off. I want to thank everybody for listening, downloading, streaming, however you get the show. There's a million different ways to get the show now. The best way still is to go to sescoops.com because there is, of course, a lot of kick-ass news stories on sescoops.com. There's other shows now and a lot of good stuff. So however you get the sound off, thank you for listening. And we will be back here next weekend, episode 272. I'm sure by then we'll know what the situation is with John Cena's injury. Since I've started recording the show, by the way, John Cena has tweeted about the injury, noting that he's banged up, but he will be on Raw this Monday. So I don't know if that means that he'll still be wrestling in the main event, that tag match with Ryback, or if they're going to keep him out of action. It sounds like there may be a legitimate injury here, but it's not as serious as was initially feared. I guess we'll find out more as the week goes on. And either way, I still like my idea. Till next time, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week on The Sound Off. Until then, have a great week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.